Now we go back to something that I suppose we won't get over for quite a while, and the people of New Zealand certainly won't. One of the most chilling aspects of the New Zealand massacre at the mosques was the entire thing was captured on video by a camera worn by the shooter and live streamed on Facebook. It remained online for 17 minutes, and in the 24 hours following the attack, Facebook removed 1.5 million copies of the footage from their platform. So that's the scale of the problem which is faced by the social media platforms, and there are other stories about them in the papers today. Apparently, some of my colleagues are involved in cases against them. So that's the scale of the problem which is faced by the social media and by legislators, and indeed those whose unenviable job is to moderate content. Well, my next guest is Rachel Holdsworth, who did that job. She worked as a moderator of the internet for 7 years, and she joins me now from London. Rachel, tell me, how did you get yourself into this unenviable situation of being a moderator?
I think I have to say, right at the beginning, I didn't consider it to be an unenviable job. I kind of enjoyed it at the beginning. It was like 2011. So what was happening, I was involved in an online startup. We were... right at the beginning, we didn't have many advertisers, we didn't have a lot of money. So to help pay my bills, I replied to an advert in The Guardian looking for content moderators. I've spent my entire working life online. I've got a lot of experience with social media and sort of slight journalism angles. So I thought, okay, this seems like something I can do. I can fix my own hours, I can work from home. So yeah.
And tell me what the experience was like when you started and how you went about work.
Mm-hmm. So I was working for an agency, and then that agency has a huge network of moderators across Europe in different languages. And we, as moderators, get assigned to different clients, all household names, all huge brands, which I'm afraid I can't name because I've signed quite a lot of non-disclosure agreements.
Right. But very big organizations would
huge,
have them.
Like,
I presume we have them here. I don't actually know. But I presume
you will,
we would
you
need
definitely
them.
Will.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And this is an extra layer of moderation. So Facebook themselves, what you tend to hear about a lot. So what you were just talking about, Facebook taking down the Christchurch videos, that's Facebook's own moderation team. But these brands put in an extra layer of moderation to look at absolutely everything that gets posted to their Facebook pages, their replies to their Twitter accounts, on their own websites. Facebook tends to only see what gets reported to them. So there's a report button on every post and every comment, and that goes directly to Facebook. But the brands themselves, the moderators, the job that I was doing, we read everything. So it's not just, you know, the stuff that somebody else goes, ooh, that's a bit dodgy.
Yeah.
It is absolutely everything, from the lovely and just the banal, to people having minor squabbles, to like comment after comment after comment sometimes, all spewing hatred.
Have you noticed that evolve over the years?
Yeah. When I began in 2011, I mean, obviously, internet discussion has never exactly been a ball of kittens. But I would say in the last 2-3 years, there has been a definite shift. And I put it down to two things. One is the rise of video. So it became a lot easier to upload things to video, a lot of talking heads, extreme right and left wing talking heads becoming a lot more popular, you know, the sort of InfoWars of YouTube, and people started sharing links to those guys a lot more frequently, and a lot more links to conspiracy theories. That just suddenly started to happen, and I'm not sure why, but 2 or 3 years ago that happened, and it's kind of a self-perpetuating cycle. You know, you see more of these videos, and you click onto YouTube. YouTube's algorithm then feeds you more of it, so you share more of it. And the second factor I put down to the Trump election and Brexit. You've got two extremely divisive issues being debated in a way that I don't think we'd really seen before. Just two camps who weren't willing to engage with each other, who decided that the best way to get their point across was to discredit the other side. And that fed down into everyday conversations, and you know, internet discussion has never exactly been somewhere that people will go, yes, I see your point, you're right. But it is now to the point where the two camps are so far apart that I cannot see a point where they come together. And dealing with that every single day is draining.
I can imagine. We were talking to somebody else who had a draining job earlier on. But it seems to me that there are, please correct me if I'm wrong, that the level of viciousness and nastiness beyond what you'd expect from your average decent human being has just gone skyrocketing.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. It's partly, I think, the anonymity of the internet, but a lot of these people are posting under their own names. You're one click away from seeing their Facebook profiles. Some people even post this stuff on LinkedIn, where you're one click away from their employer, which is just a level of dumb I can't quite fathom. But I think it's the idea that you can't see the face of the person that you're shouting at, another commenter. You can't see a reaction. And so it divorces you from the impact of your words. And there does seem to be just a general lack of empathy. And I'm not even sure that's a new thing. I think it's possibly something that has always been there. The internet has just opened the door and we just see more of it.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not going to go away, you know.
No.
But if you take a newspaper and, you know, somebody writes an article in a newspaper and it's up online, you will see commentary afterward. Now, sometimes it's not very enlightening. Sometimes it just puts a different point of view. Would the newspaper have gone through every one of those before they allowed them go up?
It depends on the newspaper.
Okay.
So the New York Times, I tend to hold up the New York Times as a beacon of good moderation. And they've got their comments policy live on the website for everyone to see. So you know exactly what's expected. You know exactly what will go through. And they also pre-moderate everything. So nothing goes live until it's been seen by a real human being. And that means they just don't open comments on that many stories because the volume would be unmanageable.
And obviously the volume of staff would have to go up and up and up.
Yeah, I mean, you get to the point somewhere where you've got more moderators than journalists.
Yes.
So this is why they've taken a view that they will only open comments on certain stories. They'll only keep them open for, say, 24 hours. And they will make sure that comment actually adds something. So that discussion actually adds something to the general debate. Most other newspapers just open comments up. Generally, they might have flags up on certain words that will...
Like swear words.
Exactly, yeah. Or certain just inflammatory phrases. And every moderation company has a huge list of these red flag words that will get sort of raised up the moderator's queue. But most of it gets looked at after it's gone live, either just by a moderator ploughing through a queue of comments or by somebody else flagging it to be looked at quickly by a moderator.
Right.
And in those situations, things can spiral out of control very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, some of the ones that I see quoted here, they say they want somebody to get raped or they want somebody to die, they want to insult. This is our species we're talking about, you know, mm-hmm. It is ourselves. What about children's content?
Children's is very different. Most of that tends to get pre-moderated, so nothing goes live without it being seen. I didn't work on much children's, partly because it's... So I did a lot of news. I actually found children's potentially more distressing than news, because a lot of the children's sites that need moderation are potentially children's charities where children are distressed or being hurt. I did a brief stint for 3 months and I had to stop. I found it too difficult.
I mean, I don't know what the solution to this is. I mean, if you look at the statistics of how much is loaded up on YouTube, or if you look at the statistics on how many are on Facebook in any given hour, how do you moderate that?
I honestly wish I had an answer for you, because what we are looking at, I mean, this isn't necessarily a technical issue. This is a human issue. We're not going to get rid of this problem because these are people. This is human nature, and people don't want to think about this. They don't want to accept this. They think, oh, but my friends are lovely. Yeah, but a lot of people aren't, and this is the problem. For as long as we have human beings, we are going to have this kind of problem on the internet. I've actually started joking to people that I think moderation should become almost like national service. Everyone should do 6 months so that they can just get a feel of what it's like.
Yeah. What did desensitise you? I mean, I know that you have said some of the things you have seen have really stayed with you. Can you tell us about them?
Yeah, so the things that really stay with me, most of the time when these discussions get had, they're the traumatic things. So, you know, I have genuinely seen what I believe to have been somebody getting... and I'm sorry for talking about this, somebody being decapitated by a tank during the failed Turkey coup a couple of years ago. I have seen what I think was the precursor to a massacre in the Rohingya genocide.
How do you know? And what do you do? Talk us through that a bit. They would be put up, I presume, for propaganda reasons.
Yes. The Rohingya genocide, there was so much propaganda on both sides, it became almost impossible to figure out. Yeah. So for those particular videos, I mean, how I know, the Turkey one, it was described as such, and it was a very dark video because the coup happened at night. I watched it once. Normally with video moderation, you're meant to watch things twice. But given how it was described and given that I'm pretty sure I saw what I saw, I did not want to go back and watch it a second time. I just removed the link.
Yeah. Are you answerable for that? I mean, can the person who put it up say, who took that down? And what right did they have to take it down?
This is another good question. A lot of times there is not a lot of recourse. I mean, somebody can post another comment to say, why did this go be taken down? They can contact the client or the brand. And in the back end, the tools that we use to moderate, if we can find the comment again, it will say that, yeah, it was my login that took it down. And quite often there is... a brief list of reasons, so you can like select one reason. Maybe it was taken down for violence, maybe it was taken down for defamation, and occasionally I have been contacted by the people I work for to say, this had a complaint, why was it taken down? And I've investigated complaints on behalf of the agency as well, and I have yet to have found a comment that didn't have at least some level of doubt with it. I mean, yeah, sometimes comments get taken down by mistake, but a lot of the time comments are taken down because people just don't understand what they can post. And this is another reason why I love the New York Times. They are very clear what the rules are.
Right. Well, no harm in that. I can see why you've given up the job to see the precursor to a massacre. That would fairly stay with you. Have you discussed it with fellow moderators? Like, who is doing this? I see that, say, young mothers with new babies take it on to get a bit extra money at home.
Yeah, so, I mean, because the job is generally home working and it's very flexible, you can more or less select the hours that you want to work. So it's very popular with mothers who've got young kids, because they can work from home, they can do as much or as little as they want to do. Like me, at the time, there are a lot of people who are using it to support other projects. So there are a lot of, say, artists or actors who are doing it to support their passion projects that don't necessarily pay a lot.
And what level of training is there? And who sets standards? So, well, obviously libel and stuff. How do you handle all of that, or contempt of court?
Things like libel and contempt of court, that's a consistent policy across every moderating project, because it's set by the law of the land. Otherwise, standards, so what level of swearing is acceptable, what level of you and I might call it bullying, but other people might call it a robust debate, let's say, what level of that is acceptable, that's all set by the brands and the clients themselves.
Right.
And in terms of training for the agency, I think they now do a full week of training. When I started, it was 2 or 3 days.
Good Lord. And for, that sounds very, very minimal.
Well, we get new training on each new project that we take on. But, I mean, bear in mind that a lot of the stuff you do, it's very much on the job. You know, you learn as you go on. You sort of figure out yourself just through volume where the line is to be drawn.
Yeah, the other thing you talk about is outrage. And the outrage stokers and those that want to, you know, exceed the previous person's outrage. Is this all new, or was that there from the beginning?
It was always there from the beginning. And if you go back to the very beginning of the internet, I'm sure it was always there. What I think is new is volume. There's a lot more of it. Whether, again, this is something that has been made more acceptable by the decline in the level of discourse, you know, national discourse, and international discourse, thinking about Trump particularly, and, you know, the sort of the online talking heads and the YouTube diatribes. I don't know, but there is definitely a lot more of it. I think it's just become more acceptable.
Would you have advice for people thinking of doing that job? Is it a well-paid job?
No. Obviously, I can only talk about the levels of pay that I got. So for the full 7 years that I worked for the agency, the basic level of moderation, so you're just assessing and removing comments, you're not replying to anybody, that was £8.50 an hour. I was chatting to one of the moderators, I still keep in touch with some of them, and they've just had a pay rise to £9 an hour. And that's not the agency, that's the clients are only willing to pay this. That's the value that they see in the moderation. The top level of pay was £15 an hour, and that was when you are communicating with people on social media on behalf of a brand, like under the brand's account, so you are posting as the brand.
Would you give advice to people on how to, you know, keep their humanity and their sanity, you know, and not to get depressed or desensitized to thinking that this viciousness should be normal?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely what happened to me. I looking back on what happened, I've definitely developed a very hard shell. I find it a lot more difficult to trust new people because I've seen so much, and I know that there are so many people out there in the world thinking these things. So just before I left the moderating job, I had a long chat with the company and said there needs to be professional counselling available and not optional, the moderators need to be having chats with a counsellor maybe every month, maybe just for an hour, half an hour a month, because it's not necessarily the big traumatic things that you see. It's not necessarily the big, you know, the aftermath of the big terrorist events where you're dealing with just a flood of hatred, Islamophobia. It always happens after any attack. It's the everyday banality of hatred. It's the everyday misogyny, the racism, the transphobia, the Islamophobia, the homophobia. It's the constant nature of it, and it builds up and you don't notice it because it's so gradual, because it's so everyday. And I think that's the danger. It's not watching videos where people are being stabbed. It's the gradual, insidious nature of it that make it, it shifts how you view the world.
Are you on Facebook?
I am, but I am very, very locked down, and I am very careful about who I connect with.
But I mean, I don't believe anybody believes that you could block anything out. Are you on Twitter?
I am. My account right now is locked down because, I've seen what can happen. But generally, I'm on Twitter. But I very carefully curate who I follow. And I have to say, since I stopped doing the job, I've been on Twitter less and less because it is quite depressing. I mean, just this morning, I was sitting in a cafe around the corner killing time before I came to do this interview.
Yeah.
And watching people sort of outrage retweet, which is actually not a good idea because it just puts hatred in other people's timelines. But I don't know if you know, there's a petition going around in the UK about revoke Article 50.
Yes,
and it's
yeah.
got 4 million signatures. And the way that the Leave side appear to be approaching this is not to say, oh, there appear to be some people with strong opinions about this, maybe we should engage. The attitude seems to be to say, no, it's all fake. And it's what I was saying about the two polarised, how polarised discussion has become. And I'm sitting there in a cafe watching this and just feeling partly unsurprised because I've seen it all so often, but also profoundly depressed.
On that cheerful note now, I hope you're doing something that's very heartwarming in your life at the moment. But listen, thank you indeed for that, because I've often wondered how they're going to police this, or will some amazing algorithm solve it? But there are serious problems. But anyway, Rachel Holdsworth, former moderator of internet content, thank you very, very much indeed for talking to us.